The date today is the 25th of January.
2013.
I'm at 412 College Street with Mathilde and her daughter Raquel in what used to be a pharmacy beginning in 1905, and it was in 1961 that Mathilde and her husband Barkev took over. So they ran it as a pharmacy together from 1961 to 2005. And 2005, it became a secondhand store, and Mathilde is still running the secondhand store. Would you like to tell us your age?
82.
82, and you're running a store by yourself.
Yes.
Congratulations.
No, she helps me.
Yes.
She's running a store by herself.
Well, she helps me. I have another daughter, older. She also comes every Wednesday. And she mostly does the paperwork, because how humble a business, there is still a lot of paperwork to do.
I'm sure that there is.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to start off by saying thank you to both of you for giving me the opportunity to meet you and to learn about your history in this neighborhood. And Raquel, you're living upstairs. So we're at 412 College, as I said, and you're living upstairs.
Yes.
Did you ever live upstairs from here?
No.
You didn't?
No. Yeah. When we got over, two floors upstairs was a bookstore, a Hungarian bookstore. And they asked us when we were buying not to evict them, to keep them here. They were happy. Two brothers running a bookstore. They were here till, I don't remember, but they voluntarily left. Yeah.
And I assume that your husband was a pharmacist.
Oh, yes.
And then I guess after he died is when you made it into a different kind of store?
Yes. We had to notify the College of Pharmacy that he passed away, and there were many drugs to be taken care of. Each company came and took their own. They were very good, very good. Apotheks, perfect. They even took the half bottles. And they refunded, I cannot say, according to their rule, they refunded. But they refunded. And he had a big order put on that day to our supplier. After 2 hours, he died.
So he died very suddenly, unexpectedly.
Yeah.
And he was healthy until then.
Yeah, he worked the day he died. Yeah, it was wonderful. Perfect health. 93. Yeah.
So he was still running the pharmacy at 93, and you're running the secondhand shop at 82.
Yeah.
You have good genes there.
I hope so.
So, I mean, how can I say that order was going to come? And when we went home, he collapsed. We had to phone them and say, hold the... But it was already put on the truck. I mean, in this country, you don't have a chance to mourn your death.
It's true.
Okay.
So, like,
the goods will come and be piled up at the door. It was...
That's hard.
Quite a hectic time. Yeah.
But you decided that you were... How did that happen, that you decided to continue running a business?
Well, it was closed for some time, till everything settled. Then we wanted to rent it as a pharmacy. Nobody wants a small pharmacy anymore. We wanted we said, okay, let's empty, and then we see what we can do. After some time being closed, my other daughter and me, and we came to sell the front shop of the pharmacy, like Kleenex, shampoo. Okay? We saw that it was working, so we started bringing things from home. Yeah, and it gives me something to do, as opposed to be alone at home.
Yes.
If you can imagine, if I can set the landscape, you know, for decades, every corner had a pharmacy, mm-hmm. and the neighborhood would rely on that corner pharmacy. But once the concept of big box store pharmacies and
shoppers
I'm not exactly sure, but there might actually be a connection between this family and Shoppers, but I've never really researched that. But that would be ironic if
so that's
the
family
Shoppers, yeah,
and that's the family that had a pharmacy in 1905.
Once the not only the chains like Shoppers, but the concept of having the pharmacy in the grocery store, once that happened, all of these pharmacy grew into such a big retail business at the same time that my parents were aging and heading into their retirement. Mm-hmm. So that's the only reason they were able to survive, because they were tapering down their business as business was dwindling. Like most small pharmacies closed, because as a small pharmacy, you could no longer order in small amounts. You were forced from, let's say, there used to be a company called the Drug Trading Company, that small pharmacists, like my parents, built that company. They owned the shares. All pharmacies owned the shares of that company. But there came a time when a small pharmacy would not be allowed to order, you know, 20 of something, or you'd have to order 100 or 1,000 of something. So small pharmacies started to try to band together to order as a little group, but frankly, most of them closed. They either passed away, or they retired, or they simply could not survive. If you can imagine, across the street in the 80s was an IDA, you know, this directly across. And so slowly, this place had always had kind of an air of overlap. Like, it had always been a place that had a little bit of the past, as you can see. But in the 80s, I would say, she slowly started to morph this place into... It started to get a secondhand feel even then. Because if you can imagine, they couldn't buy... cosmetics and sundries, they couldn't buy them at the price that people were selling them in the big box stores. Yeah, so it was no longer possible for small pharmacies to, you know, if they want to offer you a bottle of shampoo, it's going to be $7. Yeah, so
also,
some pharmacies, there was a lovely one on Bloor Street for the longest time. He was famous for, you know, he still sold Chanel perfume, and his ancestors were the people who gilded the jars. It was either his father or his grandfather. So he had beautiful pharmacy jars that were in his family. But
also,
so I don't want you to imagine that suddenly one day this became a secondhand store.
So
it was a slow 20-year morphing, a metamorphosis.
And it started off with Kleenex that she brought from that.
She didn't bring Kleenex from the house, no, but I'm saying if there was a, let's say, like a bottle or something that she liked, she had had it at home, she you know, started to bring her collection back here. Yeah, because we're all collectors.
Yeah. Also, when we wanted to rent it as a drugstore, before they ask the price, they say how many doctors are there upstairs.
Oh, so that they would send their patients down.
Yeah, that's very common. Most addresses between Dufferin and University are medical centers. So, and there's probably, oh God, maybe 60 of them. 60 to 80, probably.
Like over there, Tony at Markham Corner, he has 50 doctors upstairs.
So they wanted to.
They want the prescription to come down. Yeah. If you say I have no doctors, how can you survive? He survived because he's had his old faithful customers, and he spoke many languages.
This is Tony.
No, my she's referring now to my father. Oh. You know, my father survived because he started such a long time ago. They purchased the building such a long time ago. She's right, he spoke 10 languages, so people would come long distances to just speak to him.
People used to come from Woodbridge.
Wow. Was he connected then with, I'm not sure of the timing, of Doctors Hospital?
Never.
He did work there at some point.
Not at Doctors Hospital, at the General Hospital.
General Hospital.
General Hospital. General. Build up his apprenticeship.
Oh, for that was where he did his training?
Yeah, when he just came to Canada.
Yes.
He couldn't have, his license was not recognized.
Mm. What country was it from?
Switzerland. Well, he did the degree in Rome. He has 2 degrees, so he's a chemist and a pharmacist from Rome. And then he practiced in Iran and he practiced in Switzerland. And that was just normal. Any college here in Ontario, when you come from another country, you have to meet the requirements of the college. And so it took him approximately about between 4 and 5 years. He worked in other pharmacies in the city. So you might remember the chain Tamblyn. He worked for a Tamblyn. There was one at Avenue Road and Davenport.
Yes, he was requalifying for that time.
He was a pharmacist at the King Edward Hotel for a while. And then this family, Lilker, they found his name.
Lilker also died of heart attack suddenly. His son was a student, a medical student. He wanted to sell the store. And I think, like us, at that time, a small store was not popular. Just then, my husband had finished, he had got his license.
Oh, perfect timing.
This guy, Junior Lilker, I don't know how he got hold of his name. Wow. And he approached him. And he said, I have a pharmacy for sale. Are you interested? And my husband by then was fed up to work for others, 2 months here, 4 months there, 1 year, okay? And he used to say, never mind how humble, I'm going to start my own. So it was the right thing to do at the right time. He came, he looked, he said, just perfect for me. And this community at that time was all Jewish community, everybody. That's all right, it didn't bother us. We don't care. They were our cousins. The customers before kept coming.
Who was upstairs?
Booksellers.
Oh, yeah. Even at that time?
Yeah. And in those days there was delivery. Even a package of cigarettes was.
So you had to provide, you had to deliver.
Yeah.
That was very common. They would hire young boys. The years went on, but my brother, I would deliver. Yeah, we all delivered.
School boys. Or she was too young.
What did you pay them? You remember?
Yes. $1 a day. And how much? Here was full of chocolate and chips and whatever. Eat whatever you want. Yeah.
Was that the same thing, Raquel?
We bought.
Yes, unfortunately. Yes.
We bought a bicycle for the delivery boy, but it was not his. Like, it was our bicycle. Mm-hmm. If they left, the bicycle was for the other one. Yeah.
But you've had some of them return.
Some of the delivery boys?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we'd love to talk to one of them.
When they were grown up, fathers of families, they used to come and say, do you remember me?
Oh.
And, yeah.
Yeah, we had, I unfortunately wasn't here, but a gentleman came and said he shoveled coal for this pharmacist during the Depression. And he made a wonderful wage for that time. He made, something like 50 cents a day or a dollar a day, which was...
A dollar a day was when I know
right,
a dollar. But it went up and up and then...
But that gentleman who came and said that he had shoveled coal when he was a boy, do you remember what wage he said?
No, I don't remember that.
But, you know, all these stores had... the barn doors straight to the basement. Mm-hmm. Mars might still have theirs. Mars was one of the addresses that had theirs the longest, but otherwise they've all been filled in.
So they all had coal, you're saying?
Yes, and as in New York, all these sidewalks had metal doors outside the front that the coal would be delivered down a chute.
Do you have your, is it still, can you see it in the front?
No. That's what I'm saying, that Mars is the only address that might still have that metal door, but otherwise all of College Street, they've all been filled in because the next phase was oil.
Right.
So of course we have the oil tank down there, but then now it's a, you know, it's a gas and natural gas.
Do you have any idea when you made these changes from coal to oil to natural
gas? Was it
gas?
Oil?
When we came, it was oil.
Yeah.
Oh, it was oil when
you
came. Yeah,
we had the little cap out there. And we paid $8 a year for that cab because we were using public property, like city property.
So you paid the city that $8.
Yes. Yeah. And then one time, not too long ago, you remember they repaved the sidewalk. And I said, this is not mine. What shall I do? Okay. Man said, don't worry about it. He took it off and he paved over it. Yeah.
And when did you move to gas?
Natural gas.
I don't remember, but when oil became expensive.
Do you have air conditioning in here?
Yes.
You do. And when did you add that?
1998-7 when we renovated the whole building from top to bottom. We renovated.
Yeah, really, it would not really be possible to live on the third floor without the air conditioning, because if you can imagine, it's an uninsulated building, and it's a black tar roof. So unfortunately, that third floor is not. It has some trans.
She came back from university, she wanted to live upstairs, and then she started her share of the apartment too. Of course, with the help of a man, a worker who could do these things. The whole thing, the floor was like this. You take this out, there is another layer, you take that out, then there is oak.
Oh.
Mm.
Beautiful. So it's wood, lovely wood.
And
so you have the wood upstairs and you're living upstairs.
Yes, it had many incarnations. She mentioned the bookstore.
Yes.
But at one point it was also a dentist's office. So there are three rooms upstairs, and so the middle room would have been the dentist's office. So there's an old sink there, and you can see there's a blood on the floor into the pumpkin. And
you just yank and pull.
Yeah. At one point, it was a PI office.
What's that?
A private investigator.
Oh.
You know, like you would see in film noir. And then when I was growing up, it was the offices of a medical doctor. He was Kusevich.
Kusevich, yes.
And his wife was kind of, she just helped him out a little bit administratively. But if you can imagine, it kind of looked like Mad Men up there. You know, the modern globe pendant lights and the drawing the curtain for the examination and all grays and kind of a cold medical atmosphere. And then in the early 70s, it was the offices of two women, a medical doctor who's a psychiatrist and a woman who was a professional storyteller and a gestalt therapist.
Oh,
so they
what
each had their own room, and the front room would have been like a waiting room area. So I grew up in this building like on weekends, let's say, and sometimes I would play with their daughter and, you know, sometimes roam upstairs a little. But they stayed many, many years.
17 years.
17 years. Yeah.
The storytelling school.
Yeah.
Was that Joan?
Joan Bodger.
Bodger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did you tell me about for the tape? I'm speaking to Raquel at this moment. Tell me your work history related to this building and the pharmacy and now the secondhand store.
Well, my siblings and I, whenever there was a free moment, we were here. But there's a big age gap in our ages, so we each have a different perspective on the, you know, the neighborhood or the demographic or the time.
And what's the birth order? Where are you?
I'm the third, so my sister is 12 years older, my brother is 9 years older, and I'm the last and third. And I would say we all visited as much as we could, especially Saturdays was always a lively visiting day here, and my brother-in-law would also join us here on Saturdays. We had a long tradition.
Well, the reason you were here on Saturdays, because at one point I saw that on Saturday I have too many school kids who come to buy chips or chocolate, whatever. I said, where do you come from? They said, from the church, Saturday German school. And my husband is very fluent in Italian, German, English, Turkish, Armenian, Arab, whatever. And I had them under my foot here because I wouldn't leave them at home alone. I said, okay. I went and I said, we're not German, but I like to send my children to this school. They said, you're welcome. So the reason they were here on Saturdays, because they used to go to school, and then school is out at 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock.
So you learned German, Raquel.
Yeah, that little church, it turned into the Toronto Heritage Language Program. So most public schools would teach a language on Saturdays, mm-hmm. you know, Chinese or Mandarin,
yes.
Spanish, whatever. So I, being the youngest, continued on with that program. I actually went for 14 years every Saturday. Yeah, so it was
which
a long
did learn, and you learned German?
Yeah, yeah, long
Bundish.
Tradition.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then I, when I finished my architecture degree, at Waterloo, I came here, and I had that program at Waterloo is a cooperative university. If you can imagine, every 4 months you alternate between studying and working in a firm. And during my education, it was the first significant recession that affected architecture. So the year was 1989, and that was a landmark in the profession of architecture, in that long-standing firms with hundreds of employees became very, very small firms. So it was a challenging time in that era to get work in architecture. So whenever there were jobs in Toronto, I would sometimes stay here, and friends would stay here while we had office jobs in nearby firms. And then by the time I graduated, our needs met. This building was really in desperate need of an overhaul, and myself and friends needed a good place to live. So I spent 2 years with my colleague renovating the two floors, and we overhauled the electrical and
the plumbing.
And what year was that?
That was 95, 96.
So 96. Your family never lived in this building?
No, if you can imagine, they, most of their career, this pharmacy ran 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, while she was raising 3 children and taking care of her senile mother. So that was it. There was absolutely no attraction, no glamour to owning an old house in this neighborhood. And in the 70s, these houses had never been renovated yet. It was a lot of work. They didn't have the time. They didn't have the inclination. They had no sense of it being a romantic pursuit. And also, this neighborhood was a lot more like, if you can imagine, like a cross between Chico and the Man and Barney Miller. You know, it was
rough.
It was rough. Our neighborhood was a very different scene here.
Okay.
Yeah.
What I'd like to do is use that as a jumping off point. What years are you talking about now when you're talking about
They bought it in 61.
Okay.
And
so could we just spend a few minutes talking about the neighborhood around 60, in the 60s.
Yeah. So some of your neighbors in the 60s, do you remember their names?
Eve?
Your neighbors?
Mrs. Muginil, I was just talking about her.
What was she like? What did she do? Was she nearby or?
Oh, yeah, at number 121.
Okay. Lippincott?
Yeah.
121. And.
But generally speaking, you said that when you first bought the store, there were a lot of Jewish people in the neighborhood. If you can talk about who lived here, the larger groups who lived here, who shopped here, that kind of thing. And you were saying that it was a bit of a Wild West neighborhood, Raquel, you were saying that. So I'd really like to hear you spend a few minutes talking about what the neighborhood was like around 61 and through the
60s. It was very quiet.
Yes.
A family neighborhood, mostly, let's say, survivors of the war, Jewish people. They minded their own business. They still had that fear of a policeman, you know.
Some were Hungarian.
Hungarian, Polish, anything. Whoever escaped, whoever landed in Canada in one way or other.
And you had a neighbor who was also a pharmacist here, an older gentleman.
Cohen?
Not Cohen was there, but you had a friend who was a pharmacist, a small pharmacy in the...
Halpern.
Oh, yes, I heard about Halpern's pharmacy.
Every corner was a pharmacy.
And also, somewhere beside Mrs. Fish, there was a small pharmacy, an older man. Do you remember him?
Not beside Mrs. Fish.
Not far from her.
Yeah.
You would send me to his shop.
I know who you mean. I will think of his name. Yeah.
And Mr. and Mrs. Fish had a variety store. Their son still...
I was going to say, is Joseph Fish the lawyer there?
Mrs. Fish, her son is the lawyer there.
Yeah, he'll know many of them.
She had a...
Okay, so you're talking about the stores, that there were a lot of pharmacies. What other kinds of stores were there at that time?
There was Mario Grocery Store at corner of Borden.
Was that a Portuguese family? Mm-hmm.
Mario was Italian.
Oh, Italian.
Italian? Oh,
okay. Okay.
Sorry.
There was a jewelry store, Mr. Bogo Jewelry. One restaurant at the corner, the Greek restaurant, just before the bank.
It was Kos then.
Kos.
Yes.
Kos.
And...
Perfetti. Perfetti.
Perfetti Electric Shop.
Where the private art gallery is now.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I know the owner
Perfetti.
Of that gallery. Yes.
And then there was another man, a shoe store, children's shoe store. I used to buy their shoe from there.
And
it was variety. Now it is cafe restaurant.
The corner, computer. Yeah, the corner of Borden was a beautiful Hungarian
Bakery. Palm Bakery.
Palm Bakery.
Okay. Palm Bakery.
Yeah, it had beautiful, they would make meringues, pink and white meringues, and pile them in the window. Or
and Dobisch Tort.
Dobisch Tort and Austrian jam.
I used to give them 10 cents and go buy what you want.
Yeah, rum balls for 50 cents.
That took half an hour for me.
Yeah, a break.
A very nice lady. One day I went myself. I said, I want something which is not sweet. Do you have anything salty? I don't feel like eating some. She said, my dear, the only not sweet in this store is me.
But you knew the owners of the other stores. Oh, it was a real community. Oh,
they would send us to go get something at each of the stores, or deliver something, or borrow something, or buy something. Yeah, I mean, we sold, the big joke was we sold chocolate, but it was a thrill to go buy chocolate from Mr. and Mrs. Fish.
Yeah.
And tell them about Mr. Fish leaning on the parking meter.
Mr. Fish was standing with his elbow on the parking meter. Couple, elderly couple. Mrs. Fish and Mr. I said, oh, you're standing there doing nothing. He said, I cannot move. I just put a nickel to the meter.
He wasn't going to waste his nickel.
And Mr. Fish used to sort the Coke bottles from Pepsi, from Coke, from there. He was a lad helping his mother. And Mrs. Fish used to say, if my mother came with a check, I don't take it. So don't try to give me a check.
And cash only. She was amazing. She always used her apron pockets. She never used the cash register. She was obliged to have one, but she never used it. She did all the math in her head, and she just would take the change from her pockets. They were amazing. Amazing people, wonderful.
So remind me, what store was that? What
is it?
A very small store there.
Is it the skateboarding shop now?
But it was a
Latin American. It was Latin American at one point, not just after the.
No, but it right now.
It's right after the lane. It's right, Croft Street.
After the lane.
It might be the skateboarding address now.
Yeah.
But Mr. Fish would know.
Oh, she had such a hard time with the inspector and this cash register. And she used to say, Mister, go look in my books. I pay my taxes. What for is cash register? She had a puppy. The dollar he is. She never sold anything for a dollar. Everything was 5 cents, 10 cents.
So she was weighed down with heavy coins.
Yeah.
She was very funny, very funny man. And her son, when he became a lawyer, Mom, retire. Mom, you're doing 2 cents an hour here. Mom, why are you still here? And she used to say, I make 2 cents an hour here. Am I asking you to give me any money? I'm happy here. No. Go. Once I asked her, I said, do you own the building? She said, no, this garbage. I can put my hand in my pocket and buy it if I want. Okay. The son made him close the close the store. She didn't last 1 year.
She was much happier being out and working.
Now, when I am sweeping outside and his son passes,
Joseph.
He says, good for you. Keep it up.
Oh.
That's so sad.
Did they live in the neighborhood then?
The fishes, did they live nearby?
No, they lived on Palmerston. They had a big, nice house on Palmerston.
Yeah. Okay. And when you were growing up, did you three go to schools here in this neighborhood?
Yeah, my sister and brother went to Queen Victoria Public School.
Because we used to live downtown King and Tyndall near the exhibition.
Right.
They went to that school. And imagine in those days, after school, they used to come all by themselves with the streetcar back here. I went to school and talked to the guard, the crossing guard. I said, these two will take the streetcar. Please see to it that they do. I used to give them a ticket. And they came to Bathurst, and they changed, and I used to go and meet them there. It didn't occur to us kidnapping.
How old were they when they started to do that?
One was in grade 4, the other was in grade 1.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very little.
Yeah, very little, yeah. Yeah, but then they moved to the suburbs in 68. So I grew up in the suburbs.
Oh, so you didn't go to King Edward or... No.
Was the neighborhood at that time, was it a safe place?
Oh, yes. Very safe. Very safe. We go home and I say to my son, Greg, what happened to your tricycle? Did you put it in? Say, I don't remember. Okay. We come the next day, it is still on the sidewalk. Yeah, then the Jewish changed to Italians. Lots of Italians. And because he spoke Italian, we had... All our customers were Italians.
And then in the late 70s, more Hispanic, Spanish.
Portuguese came after the Italians.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't learn Portuguese, but he learned Spanish. And
now he's everybody.
The late 70s, I mean, there were quite a few people who had challenges with mental health and addiction and alcoholism, and there were
this neighborhood.
Yeah, especially related to all the hospitals being in this neighborhood, and before a lot of Native people were sent to reserves, and so this was more of a drop-in center, really, for people who wouldn't feel comfortable going to other places for help. And so they did a lot of work in terms of what would be called social work today, you know, mm-hmm. to get people homes, to get them ID, to get them drug benefit plans.
This is your
plans.
Father.
Yeah,
and
to
so
get them.
Did he
the disenfranchised, yeah. A lot of disenfranchised. Yeah.
And how would he refer them? He knew others in different fields to mm-hmm. say, I know a social worker. Or
yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah, but they did countless hours, what would today be called social work. So many homeless people.
So there was yeah. trust on both sides.
Oh, yes. He was. They were greatly... Yeah, they were greatly... He had a very... he had a special gift to calm and heal people, and a great gift to... I don't know how to word it, but some of his customers were CEOs of very important companies, and some of his customers were people who no one would ever want to give the time of day, but he had a great... They both had a great gift to treat everyone... You know, with respect, and people came here to feel safe, or if they had nowhere else to be, or nowhere else to sit. Or
how was the space set up then? Was there chairs and a place
yeah.
to sit?
Yeah, there. Yeah, definitely. There was a chair here, and there was a chair at that end. So that was the kind of one of the main places that someone would sit and wait for their prescription, and you would talk to them while they were waiting, you know, because in those days,
we had
he was
an
also
old
a compounding pharmacist, so it's not something that's going to take 2 minutes. It would take maybe half an hour or an hour, and then his very special customers were allowed to sit behind the desk, you know, as long as they didn't talk or touch anything. I'm talking very old men. Yeah.
One Italian customer, Rosa, she used to come from Wilson and I don't know how old. For some time she didn't come. And then one day I saw her staggering in. I said, Rosa, I missed you. Where were you? First I sit. Okay, sit. Then she said, too far. My legs hurt. I like to come to Mr. Stefano. Many people called him Mr. Stefano. Okay. But too far. I said, then you came today. She said, I go near my house pharmacy. The girl comes, say, give me paper, sit there, wait your turn. I don't like that. She comes here. Sometimes I used to make a cup of tea for her. They discuss their vegetable garden. She brings a sample of her tomato.
Yeah, it was a friendly, welcoming place for people to gather.
And my husband was a very placid man. Uh-huh. He had all the time in the world for everybody. He never hurried. He never pushed them. He never said, okay. And we had lots of Italian customers who came from far away. And at one point also, at the beginning, there were many people who had relatives in Poland, in Hungary, in Czechoslovakia. They wanted, I want to send my mother high blood pressure pills, I want to send my, okay, pills. Because he never severed his touch from the Switzerland pharmacy, he used to phone them and say, send 50 tablets to such an address in Hungary. Oh. It was easier to send from Europe to a place in Europe than from Canada. And we kept that trade till after he died. They used to phone her and say, yeah.
That was the beginning of online shopping.
That's when I think of it now, yeah. For some reason, they didn't have access to natural vitamin E for the longest time.
No, I tell you why. Because that pharmacy was under a hotel, a Savoy hotel in Zurich, which was very popular with American tourists. And those American tourists, they wanted their own American stuff. Something as simple as Philips of magnesium. If you give them something similar, no, they want Philips.
The trade name.
Yeah. Okay. So they would, sometimes I would get a call asking, you know, if we could ship them a brand of vitamin E or something. And that was still fairly recent.
So we used to ship them whatever they want. And they used to ship whatever we want to Europe. It was a good understanding. And slowly these relatives, either they came to Canada or they died, and that shipment also ceased.
I'm just watching the time for Raquel.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm okay.
Yeah.
You have to go.
I need to make a phone call, but I can make the call and come back.
It's all right. Are you going to Gestalt today?
Not at this time.
What time?
No, on the weekend.
Oh, okay. So you want to go make the call from me? I tell you, this is the worst time of the history of the store because of so many bars all around us.
Yeah. We've heard the complaints, and there's many who are neighbors that are trying to work on that, to work
next
with
door,
everybody.
It used to be a furniture store. Very nice people. 6 o'clock, they close the door and go home. They went up north in, I don't know where. They rented it to a bar. He is supposed to close at 2 o'clock. At 2 o'clock, whoever goes out, he sells them a supply. They come and they stay in my door, they drink, they get sick, they pee, they throw up, they fight, they break the bottles. I even put a light that when you walk in, didn't make any difference. I put a camera there, it's a fake camera. Okay, somebody said, even if it was a true camera, go find him. Okay.
It's because of this alcove here? Yeah.
Not that. All this corner. This corner. And graffiti. We didn't have this much graffiti.
So you're saying that the biggest change, and for the worst, has been the bars coming into the neighborhood.
Yes, the bars. They shouldn't allow bars in a residential neighborhood. In plazas, it's okay. Upstairs, you cannot keep any tenant there of the noise.
So Raquel's hearing it then?
Yes, we have done our best. Put foam in between.
So insulate, insulate against the sun.
Well, afterwards we'll talk to Raquel, and there's a group of other people right on Lippincott and College who are working with the police and the city hall to try and change it. So there's some good coming.
There is a young woman over there, first house after the church, Janice. She says every day she sends an email to Vaughn.
Yeah.
Every day.
Well, it's good. It's
because we're aware of it, but good for her for doing that.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And we have petitioned so many times. This barkeeper, after, aunts and uncles, which is a family restaurant, after that, there is a small house. He bought that house, and he started he was going to sell liquor there. We all petitioned against it.
Oh, good.
Now it is a sandwich store. But how much really is a sandwich store? I'm not commenting on that.
You're not sure if there's some other business happening?
I don't know. I cannot. I cannot say anything.
So that's very upsetting.
It was. We all knew each other. Our children knew each other. Now it's.
So it was a neighborhood, and it was a family. Family-friendly neighborhood.
Yeah. Mathilde, in the 60s when you first moved here, and you were getting to know the families, if someone said to you, where do you live in Toronto, where is your store in Toronto, what would they have called this area? Was there a name for it? Did they?
Oh, College and Bathurst.
College and Bathurst,
No name.
Yeah.
At that time, when we bought this, we used to live on King Street, King and Tyndall, which was just a few steps from the exhibition. It was all right. We didn't have a car then. We were immigrants. Don't forget that. And you're done?
That was good.
Oh, okay. We did. To come to Canada to begin with, we had to show that we had a trade. He was a pharmacist, I was a teacher. We had to show that we each had $3,000.
That's a lot, but.
And sign a paper that for 10 years we're not going to go on welfare. And there was no OHIP then.
What year was that?
57
is when you came to Canada. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to change the subject. I want to talk about the neighborhood again. What is it like being so close to Kensington Market? Has that been part of your life?
I used to shop there,
What was it like?
It was nice. They had more, like, my taste of food, let's put it that, okay? Because neighbors used to say it used to be only cabbage and potatoes before. But when I went, there was zucchini, there was eggplant, there was other things that we grew up with.
Yeah.
And yeah, there we always had the ritual of going there. And she's a prolific cook, and they're both prolific gardeners. So she wouldn't buy one eggplant. She would buy bushels. I would help her carry, and she would always be seen carrying, like, huge handfuls of bagfuls of, you know, because they would cook so many wonderful things. And as I said, we had a very full household of people, so she was feeding seven people every day.
One and of the delivery boys, you were not born there, was really a, let's say, a babysitter to my son rather than a delivery boy. And I used to give them some money, oh, big money, $2. Go to the Kensington Market. Buy. Greg insisted he wanted a artichoke. Uh-huh. And the boy says, you can't eat that. And he says, no, my mom eats. And they bought figs, fresh figs, which was, we know. And one artichoke. Okay, I said thank you, but what can I do with one artichoke?
Yeah. So you liked cooking in quantity.
Yeah.
I mean. Well, because as I said, so there were three of us and the two of them, and then her mother, and we had a tenant, and at some point we had her friend living with us as well. So sometimes
eight.
You know, sometimes eight. But everyone was at different age at a different era, so it wasn't eight all at the same time, but there was always a minimum for a long time, five. Mm. Yeah, so a lot of, and as I said, they were here most of the time, so she had to really plan her time of when and how she would cook. It doesn't make sense to cook
a
small amount.
As I said,
times.
We were new. Yeah. Money was tight. I cannot say that there was no money, but it was tight. We had a big apartment, a three-bedroom apartment, which is rare to find. Mm-hmm. And at that time, if you know Jameson Street, Jameson Avenue, they were demolishing all the small houses of the Jameson mm-hmm. and putting high-rises there. A neighbor down the street said to me, you have three bedrooms. You don't need three bedrooms. There is this man who was a tenant on James Street, Jameson. The house is being demolished. He is looking for a room, one person only. So we spoke with my husband, and we decided, yes, it will help with the rent. We interviewed this man. He's not married. He works at the Union Station. He goes in the morning, he comes at night. He says, I eat there, I don't cook here. And he even takes his showers there. All he needs is a place to sleep at night. Tom, an Irishman. He was a godsend blessing to me. He was so... There came a time that I said, don't pay me any rent, $6 a week, play with the children. And he loved them because he had all the advantages of having children around without the responsibility.
Yes, so he became like a member of your family.
Oh yes, he lived with me 20 years till he died. When we moved to Mississauga, he moved with us.
The market in those days was a big part of our lives. That was the day where they still had animals, you know, buckets of big barrels of snails crawling out of the barrels, and a lot of varieties of fish that still were semi-alive on ice or in tanks, and sharks, you know, I remember one day I wasn't watching where I was going, and I literally walked into a shark hanging upside down and rabbits in cages and pigeons in cages. And in my personal opinion, those animals were very well loved. They were well cared for, and you ordered the animal and the butcher killed it humanely there in front of you. So I think it's a little ironic that it was animal activists who protested. Those were probably the only humanely killed animals in Canada, compared to what meat we eat. So that was a terrible irony. But I would hold my nose the entire trip to the market. It was really, it was another world. There was always squashed fruit and vegetables on the sidewalk, and the cars were, as wide as the street in those days. Cadillacs or Pontiacs. And
did you live at Old Teeth?
I live on Borden Street.
Always.
Just since the 80s. Since the 80s.
You're acquainted with the Jewish market, they used to call it?
Yes, yes.
Live chicken.
Yes.
Live pigeons.
Yeah.
Fish. Snails. Whatever.
Yeah, we would get Portuguese barbecue chicken.
Yes.
Barbecue chicken.
There were a lot of Portuguese people, or cornbread. There were some bakeries. Also, the beautiful Quality Bakery was just at Bell.
That's what I remember.
Yeah.
And then at the corner.
At college, there was Quality Bakery too, just past Gordon.
Yeah, Bellevue and College. It had a central door entrance with two big windows, and they would pile the bread in the door windows, and they would serve, sponge cakes and cheesecakes by weight. So they'd have huge, deep trays, and they would cut it by weight.
And in the market at the corner was another bakery, Baldwin and Kensington Street, at the corner, a very big bakery.
Perlmutter's Bakery. Perlmutter's was in the market.
Yeah.
When
maybe
I first came
maybe
to Toronto in 1968.
Oh. What was the name?
Perlmutter.
Yeah, that was one.
And the large butcher. Now it's a
European butcher.
Yeah.
Now it's closed.
It's a new butcher.
It's a new butcher now.
Oh.
So there were Hispanic people here. I remember in the late 70s, we had some neighbors who were truly Romanian gypsies. They were an infamous family. The matron of that family, nobody messed with her, and her children tended to get their own way.
Where were they? Right here on College?
Where did the gypsy family live? Do you remember?
No, refresh my family, my memory. The
mother was quite a robust figure, and her boys were also very robust.
I know. On Butter Street, just south of College, those little houses there.
For a little while, there was a kind of a leftover descendant, a palm reader. And then we had Mexican tenants at some point. I still have the books to prove it. They're still in the wall where they had
a hammock
hanging. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, and then this infamous address right here, it's now this tiny little house, the third one right here. That was a...
And so they do roti now?
Yeah, but when I was growing up, it was owned by a hitman, a bald man who wore a fedora. He would have a brass band around his head, and he had a Fu Manchu mustache and often a suit. Do you remember his name?
He had many names.
He called my father Boss.
He called your father Boss.
Yeah, called my father Boss. Yeah.
And what did your father call him?
What did my dad call him? What did he call him? He did have a name.
Yes, but
how did you know he was a hitman?
He was bold. He was very bold, and he used to call him Kalosh.
Kalosh, yeah.
Kalosh.
Yeah, he wore pointy boots and mobster suits, and you could tell he was connected to a long underworld. And then there literally was a shooting there. We presume he
was
someone.
A what you call ouster or ouster, ouster mm-hmm. at and bars. He throws the drunk people out.
Oh,
a bouncer.
A bouncer.
So he worked as a bouncer.
That was his
cover.
One of his.
That was his
one
front.
Of his
yes. Yeah.
But one day he came here. At night, he put a fence around his house. Uh-huh. If you remember, a 6-foot wood fence.
I never knew what was under it.
Yeah, okay. One day he came here and he said to my husband, "You know nothing, you saw nothing, you speak nothing, you don't know me, you're..." And my husband says, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Good, you know nothing."
Wow.
Then inspector comes, "What about this wall? Who made it? Who could?" My husband said, "I don't know. I came one day, it was here. He built it at night." Yeah. And I had a friend who had difficulty with her husband. We used to joke and say, "You know, I know a man who can take care of Peter."
During the night, he does fences, or...
He was a... Yeah.
No, he was good with us because we didn't mess with him. No.
But there were many characters like that. Many.
Okay, so you've talked about the gypsy family and this bouncer.
Yeah.
Can you think of one or two or other of these characters of the neighborhood?
Well, there were many, many benign characters. There were many disenfranchised men who, for one reason or another, left their lives as they knew it. You know, they were a banker, or they were the father of three, or they were an architect, or many people who became homeless men who had some reason, some trauma, why they left the life as they
knew it.
Were
there many rooming houses then?
Yeah, the Salvation Army, for the most part, they would stay at the Salvation Army. And they would sometimes, if they got some kind of government assistance, sometimes the two of them would kind of help them by... Sometimes they wouldn't have an address, you know, like they would arrange, if you don't, it's a vicious circle. If you don't have an identity, you don't have an address. If you don't have an address, you can't get the proper medical care or the proper benefits. Or so sometimes they would, for people who simply just could not cope, they would keep their funds for them, and they would make sure that they could come and get them here by, you know, so they wouldn't spend it all at once, or...
They'd use the address here.
Yeah, they'd use the address here, and my parents would make sure that they'd keep a ledger for each person, and it's like, this is your money.
I cannot tell you how many people I filled their old age pension paper, apply for a job, apply for welfare, apply, and one of them said, "Miss, put a chair here and a table, you do better business than that girl over there." And so many.
But a lot of these men, especially, there were a lot of Native people who were completely disenfranchised. A lot of them had severe alcohol problems. And also in the late 70s, early 80s, there were a lot of people who had more severe addictions to narcotics or drugs. He had a methadone program here at some point. A couple of people had to... deal with that, and it was always an unusual place in terms of people who just simply wouldn't be welcome or wouldn't be accepted or would be made to feel ashamed to. They would simply not be able to walk into a Shoppers or whatever else was an option. You know, or as she said, he was patient, and often he could speak their language, and he had a great quality of being able to calm people who were disturbed, especially mentally disturbed people. So, and a lot of them were, frankly, you know, schizophrenic. Many of them were schizophrenic. We have some paintings. You might see some writing. There's some paintings. You know, people would pay him in paintings or whatever if they needed something. They were kind of like the grandparents.
Only from this street people, there is only one who is still around.
Yeah.
You know him, maybe. He walks around. He lives at Sittenhaus. He is entitled to a certain amount of money every month from his check that goes straight to Sittenhaus.
Yes.
If you don't ask, they don't give. Okay? Mm-hmm. You have to go and to the office and ask for your share. If you don't ask, they don't give. He comes and he begs. I am phoning for him. I say, Mr. Ivol here, his name is Ivol Krezo, a Croatian man. If you tell him where is your country, where do you come from, he will say camp, camp. It means during the war he was in a concentration camp. That's all he remembers. I phoned and I said, here, Mr. Krezo, he has to have his pocket money. It's a shame that he is begging. Is he related to you? I say, no. Sorry, we cannot talk to you about him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So somebody has to take him to the welfare office? Is that what has to happen?
Well, the Seton office, then they distribute, but you have to be registered there.
And I say to him, Ivol, go to the office. They will give you money. He walks till the fire station. He forgets. And then he comes, $5, please, $5.
Is this the very tall, with gray long hair?
No.
And
no.
He's got always carrying
no hair?
No, this man is very, he has a very round head, no hair, like short hair, quite tall, broad, usually a long coat. And he is, for the most part, silent. He just walks silently and he does not drink. He doesn't drink and he doesn't make any physical gestures.
He shakes every door to see if it is open.
For a while he would yell. He would come, you know, at 7 in the morning and start yelling. He would march up and down the street and yell. You know, probably, you can imagine, he woke the people at the camp. You know, so 50 years later he would march up and down the street and he's yelling to wake everyone at 7 or 6 or whatever on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But one time he tried to break in that door. I didn't know who he was yet. And I was alarmed, and eventually I saw him and I said, you know, this is the man who tried to break in. And she said, oh, well, that's Ivol. We've known him for 30 years. And he wanted the doctor upstairs. And so he came and he asked you about the doctor.
I said, he is dead. He said, okay, I wait. And he comes now, if he comes in, he goes round the corner and he says, Doctor Underground? I say, yes, Doctor Underground.
Somebody understands.
Yeah.
But I think what you're talking about is the amount of kindness that happened in this space has just been remarkable for decades.
My husband used to say to these people, some of them used to call him Dad. He said, your own father was not so good to you as I am.
I think so.
You better do this. Okay. For example, this Ivol, he was in on medication. But people rub him because they think it is narcotic. So he used to come every day for a pill. We used to give him one by one, one by one. Hmm. Now they do the same thing at Sittenhaus. Each person who has a prescription, they get their pill every day.
Yeah.
Because if you have it in your pocket, a smart person might think it's a narcotic.
It sounds like some of your practices and your relationships with people made this common sense and kindness on your part, but it was the forefront of some of the health practices now with community clinics and practices. So it's wonderful, wonderful.
You were doing it out of the goodness of your heart.
Yes.
No, I need a prescription.
There was a need. Yeah. There was a terrible need.
But your parents provided it.
Yeah.
Now I need a prescription, let's say. I need medication. Yeah. Like everybody else, I go there. I give my prescription, I wait. They call me, I pay them, that's it. oh, how are you? How is it?
What? Yeah, that's why people would come a long distance. And also sometimes, you know, like anything, knowledge takes time. So there were many diseases where at the time it was not acceptable to speak about them. I mean, we speak about cancer now, but for a long time, no one would ever...
It was always the question, should we tell them
or
shouldn't
we? No one would speak about that out loud. And then when AIDS came, many people came
another
long distances to, you know, to hide their identity. They didn't want to, like a CEO wouldn't want to run into someone at their local pharmacy, so they would literally, this was kind of an oasis of anonymity. You know, people would be able to come here and... A lot of people, my father, I remember him telling me that he was sure he knew, which is goes with that profession. Sometimes you know, especially also in therapy, you might know people in a way that their own families don't know them at all. So,
oh, sure.
You know, you have that.
And there's the confidentiality.
The confidentiality, absolutely. And that was, he was just a master.
And that has to do with respect.
Yeah, he was a master at that. And he had such an old world education. You know, in Italy, a pharmacist is called a doctor. A pharmacist is allowed to diagnose and allowed to compound. So he came from that tradition. So, you know, over the decades in Ontario, the rules with the College of Pharmacy changed. At some point, he was no longer allowed to compound. And of course, the industry of pharmaceuticals changed, and, you know, pills were delivered ready-made in the billions.
Many people who were cash paid customers, they would come and say, the doctor wrote this, what do you think about it? I say, I don't know, your doctor knows you and he wrote this. How much does it cost? Okay, maybe, let's say, in those days, $28, $30. Is it good? Your doctor wrote it. He said, you know what I can do? I give you 12 pills instead of 50. Go take 12 pills, pay me for 12 pills. See, does it make you sleeplessness? Does it cut you? Does it make you nauseated? Does it, you like it? Come take the other 40. You don't like it, you only lose 10 pills worth. You go to your doctor and you say, this, it makes me, it gives me headache, or it keeps me awake, or he used to do that a lot to these cash paying customers, instead of saying, the hell with you, give me your $20, here are your pills. Because I think he grew up very poor and he sympathized with poor people. He was very poor when he grew up.
Well, but you were part of it too. I mean, the two of you took care of a lot of people in the neighborhood.
Okay.
When she was 61. Yeah, when she started, she was 31. When she started here, she was 31.
When they arrived in 57.
No, but when they bought the pharmacy.
In 61. Yes.
Okay.
37.
We're going to stop there. About to stop. What do you see over the next few years, Mathilde? What's your plan?
I don't know what I see tomorrow. I will come here as long as I can. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because the day is too long to be alone at home. How much can I clean? How much can I read? I don't have a computer at home. I don't have television at home. Okay? I have 5 grandchildren. I always, every week there is somebody who wants me to do some mending, some alteration, some... The button is gone, the pocket has a hole, the jeans are too long. Okay, I do that. But you never know what will happen tomorrow.
But as long as you're well.
As long as I can drive, I passed my driving test. You ladies don't have an idea about that. In Ontario, if you are 80, you are called to pass your driving test. So for the second time at 80 and 82, I passed my driving test. Today I did not bring the car because it said 80% snow. If it is 80% snow, it is, I don't like to drive till Mississauga. But so far there is no snow. I don't know what will happen tomorrow.
Did you mention a documentary?
Yeah.
What was that about?
About 3 years ago, a young couple, Callie Anderson and Zachary Finkelstein, they have their own small original filmmaking company, and so they made a 9-minute film called Stefanian. So if you Google Stefanian, there's a trailer, and you can order the documentary through them.
Was it good?
Yes,
did you think it was
good? 9 minutes. It's I'm in it for a few minutes, and my voice, the narration is shared with myself and her, and it's the story of how she made this shop, her secondhand shop. Which a lot of things covered. Here.
Sure.
Yeah, they they were interested in her and her story of how she made it, how she morphed it into a secondhand shop. So the documentary is more about that than it is about it, the life of it as a pharmacy in the past.
And another reason I come here, I know more people here than I know where I live. It's so... Nobody... My husband used to say, good day to today, hot day today, cold day today. They said they told me the temperature.
Well, if you were here 12 hours a day, sure you didn't get to know your neighbors up there.
He used to go out and come in and says, okay, Mr. Mr. Sandrovich told me the temperature. Good day today, sunny day today, cold day, windy today. That's it.
That's enough.
Okay, I know. Here they come. At one point, he fell. This is many years ago. 22 years ago, Olin was just being born. We went out. Somebody had blocked our car. He said, you go that way, I go that way. Let's see who owns this car. He had two wheels on the sidewalk, two wheels on the street, but just where my car is. I come back, I see him on the floor. He had tripped and hit his head to the wall. Okay. We called the ambulance. We went. They put a tape over it and they said, don't fall again. That's it. The next day, I see that the spoon fell from his hand. And he is shuffling. I said, we'll go to the doctor. We went to the doctor. He said he had a mild heart attack. I said, no, he fell. No, a mild attack. The day after, the third day now, terrible. So I took him to emergency near my house over there. We told him what happened. A neurosurgeon came. He's taking the story. He turned out to be a guy from King Edward's School.
He knew the story.
And he said, oh, we used to call you the old man even then. And he said, did you steal my chocolates and my chips? He said, well. He said, okay, do a good job. I forgive you. They took out a 3-inch blood clot from his brain.
Yeah, subdural hematoma. Yeah.
Caused by the fall, or? Yep.
He would have been paralyzed for the rest of his life. That doctor said he had a mild stroke. I said, no, he fell. No, he fell. And these people, they did not even x-ray him. They just put a band-aid and they said, don't fall again. They opened his head this big. And then it was all staples all around it.
Anyway, very lucky man. No problem.
Yeah. No problem. That left no effects.
Well, that's good.
No,
you took him in.
No effects. Lucky. But that doctor kept being a friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was also Dan Yashinsky's friend.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Do you remember
Dr. Seltzer.
Seltzer.
Seltzer. Seltzer.
Okay, we'll try to find him.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to turn this off now, but first I want to say to Mathilde and Raquel Stefanian, and to Diddy Biggs, who's sitting with me here participating, thank you very much. You told us, you gave us very rich, interesting information about the neighborhood, about your history right here, and you're still here. And you're a wonderful storyteller. You speak so clearly. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
And thank you. And thank you very much.